This is Girl on the River, the podcast. Whole crew, come forward to row. Hello and welcome back to Girl on the River, the podcast for episode 17. First of all, I'd like to say a big thank you to every single person who got in touch following last week's interview with Pete Reed. So many of you have been inspired by his attitude and his determination and by the wisdom and life lessons that he shared during the interview. And the idea of ethical fitness has particularly struck a chord. If you haven't yet listened to it, you can find it and all the other episodes of the podcast at girlontheriver.com or on your podcast app. As always, I love to hear from you, so do get in touch anytime on social media at girlontheriver on all channels or by email at girlontheriverpodcast@gmail.com. And if you can take a minute to rate or review the show, for some reason it helps disproportionately with the algorithms and makes it more visible. And I would be incredibly grateful if you could just take a minute to do that. My big news is I'm going to take a break from the podcast for the month of April to have a bit of a rest and to devote some time to the rest of my life, as running a podcast can be pretty intense. So after next week's episode, you won't hear from me until May, when I will be back with season two and loads of brilliant interviews. In the meantime, I'll still be leading a Zoom Ergos session. It'll be on Wednesday mornings at 7:30 for the time being, though there will be a bit of shuffling around, I think, when things start to open up. So just keep an eye on my social media. If you have access to a rowing machine or an exercise bike or a treadmill and you haven't yet joined in with one of these sessions, it's free and you don't have to be a member of anything to join. You just sign up at zoomergos.com. Nobody knows or cares how good you are or how hard you're working. That's the joy of it. It's all about just getting together with other people to exercise. Now, my guest this week is less of a household name than Pete Reed, but no less brave. Always looking for adventure, Ian Rivers spent his career in the SAS, where he trained as an ocean yacht master, learning navigational skills that later stood him in good stead when he was kidnapped in Syria. But I'll let him tell you about that bit. In May this year, he is setting off on another adventure, a solo unsupported row across the North Atlantic from New York to the Scilly Isles. And instead of relying on GPS, he's going to be navigating using just a sextant and a set of charts. You might expect someone with such a swashbuckling past to have a bit of swagger about him, but I have to say Ian is also one of the most calm and understated people I've ever met. Ian, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, we are here because of a huge challenge that you have got coming up. But before we get onto that, it would be great for the listeners just to get to know you a little bit better. So introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who you are and what has brought you to this point.
I grew up in London. I was born in Dulwich in London, and I can only describe it as very feral. You know, we had a really great time. We used to run out and down the streets all the time. You know, there was no distractions with modern technology that we have today. You know, it was kids out playing with other kids, and it gave me a real taste for adventure. And when I was leaving school, halfway through my A-levels, I realised that I was a bit bored of academia. You know, I wasn't really going to go to university, and not many people did from my school used to go to university anyway. It was one of the largest comprehensives in West London. And so I decided I'd join the army. And I thought, I just don't want to join the army. I do something a little bit special. So I wanted to join the commandos. And the recruiting sergeant sat in front of me was from the artillery. So he convinced me to join the artillery commandos. Which I did, and it was hugely, hugely rewarding. And when it comes to physical challenges, I always say basic training for me was the hardest physical training I've ever done, because I went from a very, very, very skinny 18-year-old when I joined the army, and the shock of actually joining the army was a real shock. And the physical transformation into sort of like becoming a soldier, that physical training, it was actually quite hard.
So what did it involve?
Training was 12 weeks, and like most things in the army, you learn to march, you know, you do camp craft, you do all those sort of things. But the physical training, it was really, really hard. So there was speed marches, there was running, there was assault courses, there was cross country, there was all sorts in there and all sort of timed. And at the time, they were trialing new fitness regimes, and we were sort of part of that process. And it's interesting how people develop physically, having the same food, the same training, the same sleep patterns, but you all develop physically and different fitness levels. And it was interesting, at the end we had a big test run to see how fit we were, how fast we could run. And I was very, very slim. You know, I was probably at about 75 kilos. And as I sit here now, I'm 95. And I passed out the fittest soldier in my intake, not because I tried to be the fittest soldier. It's just that physiologically, I became the fittest soldier through the regime. And, you know, other people were just as fit as me. It's just that my heart rate was lower at certain points. And that kind of like stuck with me, really. And it sort of thought, right, yeah, I kind of like this physical stuff. I'm just going to challenge myself as I go along. And the next challenge was a commando course. Went down to Plymouth, straight out of training. So I had no experience as a soldier apart from basic training. So these were all really experienced soldiers. And this sort of like spotty 18-year-old turned up. And they were really, really welcoming. It was that kind of esprit de corps with sort of like wearing a green beret. And again, because you're now a trained soldier and a lot fitter, I found it a lot easier and a lot more enjoyable. And the camaraderie that the Green Beret brings, it kind of really bonds people together. And I've still got good friends from that time now. But once I got my Green Beret, it opened up again big avenues to sort of like going to Norway, skiing in Norway, cross-country skiing, all around the world, really. My first real posting when I was in the military was to Belize. And it was fantastic. I really, really did have a great time. You know, ended up with a fantastic suntan as well.
I'm sure.
And the conversation, really, when you're in these sort of like specialist units, like the commanders or the parrots, is they're always talking about the next specialist unit, you know, the next level up. If you really want to sort of like push yourself, you need to go to the next level. So I was spent 6 years in the commandos. And when I was 24, I volunteered for selection. You know, I had no idea how it kind of worked, really. I wasn't overly tuned into it. It was just, for me, it was a physical and mental challenge because it was the next level. And as a professional soldier, you wanted to push yourself to the next level. And I can only describe it as just ordinary people, really, like myself, that have just come from ordinary places around the UK, just doing extraordinary things. You know, and there is an element of luck in there, so you don't get injured. But it's that sort of like resilience of fitness, that mental aptitude of keep pushing yourself day in, day out for very long periods of time. And it stuck with me still. So I find myself doing challenges all the time, you know, big, long, hard challenges. And that kind of mental fortitude, really, I take into all my projects that I want to do.
So you progress through from challenge to challenge, always pushing yourself that bit further, and ended up in the special forces. And I appreciate you can't talk about your work there, but I'm curious to know, you describe your colleagues there as ordinary people doing extraordinary things, but there must be a type of person, there must be a mindset that has something extra, something that is prepared to endure the physical rigors and the dangers and all that goes with it.
Yeah, I suppose it comes down to sort of like the pursuit of excellence, you know, which kind of like sits above the mantra of the special forces. They just have the same kind of mindset that they always want to do the best. And that really always pushes the project or whatever you're on forward in sort of like positive outcomes. You know, it's not always positive. You know, some things don't always go how you think they're going to go. The secret to that is, if it's a negative, you learn from it. And sometimes you have to have a failure of some sort to learn from it, because you know, if you always sort of get it right every single time, I think it makes you a better person if you've actually failed in a few things. And then you've learned from them, you can review them, you can analyze them, and actually make it better the next time.
Do you consider yourself to be a particularly brave person?
No, not really. No. I mean, it probably goes back to the mindset. And you make your own luck. You know, have I been scared? Absolutely. Have I been terrified? Absolutely. But, you know, the training that you've done, the luck, the preparing you've done has sort of kind of given you the confidence to actually step forward and do your job or push on with your project or your climb that you're doing or swim, particularly the dangerous swim that you're doing or the current project, which is the row. You know, I mean, that's like a big step into the unknown.
Yeah, certainly is. So during your time in the forces, I see from your film, which I will link to in the show notes, it's absolutely brilliant, you became an ocean yacht master. So you're no stranger to the dangers of the sea. So tell me a little bit about that and as much as you're able, what that involved and how you came to be. Was it a choice to get into the sailing side of things, or was that something you were allocated?
No, that was just a purely selfish point of mine, and because I enjoy the ocean.
That's good.
Yeah, exactly. But the main reason I got into the Yachtmaster Ocean is because of the navigation side of it. Most people know now, if you go navigating around the coast, you can use GPS. You can normally see lights, lighthouses, buoys, and that type of thing. But part of the criteria for being a Yachtmaster Ocean is you have to use sextants to navigate with.
You might need to explain what a sextant is to the non-sailors in the audience.
Yeah, so most people navigate just using the GPS, and you just sort of like look at something that looks like a phone, and it tells you exactly where you are in the world. But going back 100 years, the navigators then on ships and the early sort of like flights, they would have to use the stars and the sun to navigate with. And you'd pick a star, and at a certain time of the day, you would work out the angle between the horizon and where the star was. And what you'd measure that angle with is a thing called a sextant. It's a very simple tool, really. It's by a protractor. You put one end of it on the horizon, and then you just bring a sight up to the sun or the star that you particularly want to take the sight of, and then it'll give you an angle. And then at a particular time of day, some really, really intelligent person has worked out where you'll be on the earth at that particular point, given that angle. And it puts a mark either on a map or a chart in a latitude and longitude. And that's, for me, that's what I like, is pure navigation. It's using Mother Nature to tell you where you are in the world. And it adds an element of fun as well to it, rather than just looking at a screen that tells you where you are every minute of the day.
And I gather you had to use some navigation skills when you were in Syria. It sounds like there was quite a drama there. So tell us what happened and how you got out of the situation you were in.
Yeah, we got into quite a pickle. I mean, it was just before Christmas. We found ourselves kidnapped.
Do you know who kidnapped you?
Yeah, they were basically rogue elements of the Free Syrian Army. It was before what we would call ISIS, you know, those type of guys. You know, they had ulterior motives to taking people like myself and the guys I was with. But after about 6 days, they were moving us. And it was quite strange because prior to that, we were shackled 24/7. We were blindfolded 24/7, given very little food, moved quite frequently at night to different locations. And this particular day, it just turned to nighttime. And if you imagine, you're sort of shackled, you've got a blindfold on, so you don't really know whether it's day or night, you know, because it's dark all the time. And as one day passes into another day, your time clock starts to get skewed a little bit because you haven't got day and night to tell you what it is.
When most of us think about a kidnapping situation like that, you imagine someone kind of carving out the days on the wall or something, but you weren't able to do that. That must have been really difficult.
No, they were quite aggressive. So if you took your blindfold off or showed any movement, they got quite angry with you. You know, so we tried not to do that too often. So the thing that really gave us the day and night was the call to prayer from the mosques. The call to prayer in Syria, and like most Muslim countries, is first light, lunchtime, and last light. And so if you can imagine the last call to prayer, there would be a big gap. And then there'd be a short gap between the first one, the next one, and the next one. And then you could create a body clock from that, really. And that's what we did. So we'd lie out, right, yeah, it's call to prayer. It must be about 6 o'clock in the morning. And then the last one would be about 6 o'clock at night. And obviously the midday call to prayer gave you the daylight window. So most times they moved this was after the last call of prayer. So it would have been sort of like anywhere between 9 and midnight. And then we'd get moved to a new location. But this time they moved us before the last call of prayer. It was dark because it's winter. I don't know how people, you know, envisage Syria, but when it's wet and miserable there, it's very dark because there's not much ambient light. So it was very, very dark. So they moved us. And after about an hour in a vehicle, the vehicle we was in was ambushed by another group. So there was lots of gunfire. There was lots of screaming and that type of thing going on. And in the melee, I escaped. And the irony is the guys that ambushed us were coming to rescue us.
Oh, gosh.
And the guys that were in the van, so I literally came out of the van to try and get the people out of there because you don't really want to be in a vehicle when there's lots of gunfire because it kind of draws that type of thing in. And I fell off the road in the darkness, rolled down a bank. By the time I crawled back up the bank and got on the road, everyone had gone. The vehicles are gone. The kidnappers are gone. The people that ambushed are gone. And I was stood there on my own. You know, it happened that quickly. And it was pitch black, absolutely dark. And I was just, I best start moving because I don't need to stay here. Because I obviously didn't know what happened. So all I saw was two tail lights, you know, the rear lights, the red lights, the two vehicles driving away on the road. And I was stood there and it was pitch black.
Did you have any idea where you were?
I kind of had an idea because every time they moved us, we never really went far. We were always geographically probably within 10 kilometers of where we originally got picked up, got kidnapped. So I made a quick decision. I thought, right, I need to get to the high ground. Got on my hands and knees and tried to pick a horizon around me. It was pure fluke the first time that I found some high ground and I just literally ran to it, falling over, running into trees because it was so dark. Got to the high ground, which it didn't really take that long, maybe sort of like 10, 15 minutes. And it's almost indescribable, the euphoria of actually suddenly become free. So I had broken my shackles. I'd taken my blindfold off. Unfortunately, my footwear wasn't particularly good. So I've got size 11 feet. And this particular night, they squeezed my feet into size, I can only describe it, probably about size 7, maybe even a 6. And they'll just slip on the shoes that a lot of people wear in the sort of like Middle Eastern countries because they take their shoes off before they go in the house. So they're quite wet, slip-ons quite a lot. And probably an hour into the escape, my feet had burst through the front of these shoes. So from the ball of my foot onwards was now into the dirt. But I had to decide which way I needed to go. I had nothing to tell me which way was north. And I needed to go. I knew I had to go north because that's where the border crossing point was. So the first indicator, it was an educated guess, but there's hundreds of thousands of olive trees in that region. And most of them are 50 to 100 years old. And they've grown generally towards the sun. They've just got that kind of lean, the branches lean that way because they're all trying to get the sun's energy. So I put my back to a couple of trees, had a look at the lineup and a couple of trees in the size I could see. And it was very dark. And I just went, right, they're leaning towards the sun, which is to the south. So the other way must be north. The only light in the area was an airbase called Taftanaz. and it was a regime air base. It was probably about 10 kilometers away from where I was. Well, they had a big searchlight there. It was the only light I could see for miles. There was no other light. So I decided when I had the trees behind me, the light was over my right shoulder. If I kept that light as I moved left and right, kept it over my right shoulder, I should be generally going north. So I walked all night with that light on my right shoulder, trying not to get caught again.
Did you continue feeling euphoric, or did that feeling wear off and the sort of enormity of what you had to do next hit you?
No, I was extremely happy. Make no bones about it. I was happy. My feet were sore. It was incredibly wet and cold, and didn't really have much clothing. So by the time it started to get daylight, and I was looking for the main road. If you can imagine, there's not very many big roads there, but there was one main road, and if I found it, it ran north to south. It would be my sort of like handrail to the border crossing, because I knew it went to the border crossing. And in sort of like UK terms, it's like coming across the M1. You know, it'd be that big. You'd know it's the motorway as such. So that was my task. I thought, right, I needed a bit of north, a bit of east, and I hopefully should bump into that road, because that's what we was kidnapped off. That's what we were on when we got kidnapped. So I thought I'd handrail it back to the border crossing. And I walked all night. So probably 8 to 10 hours of walking, pretty much not being able to see much in front of me.
Presumably no water or anything like that during that time.
No. I mean, they didn't really feed us when we were captive, really. They gave us a bit of food each day and a glass of water. So we weren't in the best shape at the time. But, you know, we can all cope with a little bit less food. But I could hear the call to prayer. It was dark, but I could hear it coming up on a couple of villages around me. And then I came out an olive grove off the hill, and I found the road. And it was a bit of a eureka moment. I'm like, yeah, this is it. I've got it. You know, I found my road. And I stood on there as it got daylight, looking up and down it, trying to work out actually which way on that road was north and south, given that I thought I was going north, but I hadn't actually confirmed it. There was a building next to the road. I thought, if I go in there, I'll be nice and dry, because it was wet and raining. But then I thought, if someone comes in there, they'll see me and I'll go through the same experience again. So I went back into the olive groves, found a big pile of rocks that the farmer had dragged together in the olive grove, and just laid in there in the day and hid during the day in these rocks, exposed to the rain. So I was getting wet and cold. And I thought, right, I'll try and sleep a little bit, because it's been a busy night. And I couldn't, because I was just too cold. And there was lots of gunfire going on around, because obviously it's a war zone, and that kind of kept me alert. And then at midday, I thought, right, I'll see the sun, and I could work out from the sun which way is north and south. But it was raining, it was misty. And then I just sort of sat there and thought, what side of the rocks does moss grow on? And I thought, 80% of it's on the north side, isn't it? They always grow on the least sunny side of the rocks. And it confirmed to me then that I looked at my pile of rocks, and there on one side was lots of moss, and there on the other side was just a little bit. So it confirmed that I had actually been going north, and the road, which was now about a kilometre away from me, was actually going in the right direction. I was on the right side of it. And if I kept it on my right side, I would be going north. And those were my two navigational eureka moments whilst on the run.
So eventually you found your way to safety.
Yeah, so 3 days later, I got to the border with Turkey, with a little help of a friendly family that I came across the next day. And I sort of spent 2 days in my pile of rocks waiting for darkness and just sort of like assessing where I was, because I didn't particularly want to get caught again. I also didn't really know what happened to the other guys, although they were in now safe, because the guys that were looking for them found them. So I was worried about them. So I thought I needed to get out just to sort of like say where we are. And day two, I think it was, on the run, I came through a village at night just as it gets getting dark, and recognized it was quite a friendly village. Just the way they were dressed, their mannerisms and how they were talking in Arabic. And so I approached him in my worst Arabic, and I'm not an Arabic speaker at all, very, very poor colloquial. And I went up to some teenagers and basically said, hi, you know, have you got any water? Because if you ask someone for water over there, they will give it to you. And then I had a real brief conversation, you know, where's the border? You know, he said that way, which confirmed again the direction I was going. I started to walk off, and then I said to him, well, how far is it? And he said, oh, it's in a car, it's like 2 hours, and I'm walking. But there's lots of checkpoints on the way, that kind of thing. That's what he meant by 2 hours. But on a clear day, during the day, it had been about 45 minutes in the car, because it was about 20 to 25 kilometers away. And given that I wasn't making very much speed, that was like probably another 3 days walking for me, if I didn't get caught by someone that was looking for me. And the kind of like the funny side of it was, the guy said, look, you know, come to my house. And straight away, you can tell by the customs and etiquettes of how the women in the family dress. And she was dressed quite liberally, just had a headscarf on. And they invited me in and chatted away in sort of broken English and broken Arabic. And they said, look, you know, the irony was the head of the house was the English teacher for the village. So when the dad turned up, he spoke to me in English and just made the communication piece that much easier. And from there onwards, spoke to some friendly Free Syrian Army guys, and they guaranteed my safety, well, they said they would. And true to their word, the next day they came and escorted me to the border. 3 days in, finally got out of there. Like,
that is quite a tale. And I think it leads neatly into talking about your next challenge, because I think what really comes across from that is your coolness under pressure and ability to look around you and deal with whatever you're facing. And those navigational skills, you know, most people wouldn't think about looking in at the direction that a tree was growing on. So your next challenge is rowing the Atlantic, but you are not doing it the way most people row the Atlantic. Every year there's a bunch of brave and slightly foolhardy people who set off from La Gomera in the Canary Isles and row to Antigua, but that's not what you're doing. So tell us what you're doing.
That's right. So I was after a challenge. I love the ocean, and I've always wanted to row it. And probably nearly about 15 years ago, I almost done the La Gomera route to Antigua when it was called the Woodvale Challenge. But, you know, I didn't want to do it with other people. I wanted to just do a solo row in a piece of ocean that not many people row in. Originally, I was going to go for St. John's in Canada, which is probably the shortest route across the Atlantic in the north. It's just over 2,000 nautical miles. It's still quite a treacherous piece of water. But then I was like, well, it's not quite far enough. You know, it needs to be a little bit further. So I was moving down the coast, and I came across New York. And when you look at what people have got up to, very few people have left New York solo and got to the other side. And there's a guy called Ollie Hicks, a young lad. He was 21, but he got halfway across, and he got short on supplies, and the Royal Navy came out and resupplied him. But he eventually got across, but unfortunately for him, it became a supported trip. So this, for me, is going to be unsupported. So I will leave New York, head for the Isle of Sillies, and it won't be supported.
And this has quite an interesting history. I reviewed a book for the blog, and I'll put a link to that review in the show notes, a book called Salt, Sweat and Tears by Adam Rackley, and that charts the history of ocean or Atlantic rowing. And it all kicked off in 1896 with a couple of Norwegian fishermen who did this. And I've seen a picture of the boat that they rowed this route. It was the same route, wasn't it? It was New York to the Sillies. And they did it in what looked like just a kind of ordinary open fishing boat. Quite extraordinary, nothing self-writing or anything like that. So have you sort of looked to people like that for inspiration, or is it more to do with the physical challenge?
It's a combination of both, really. So A, it's a physical challenge, and that's why I'm doing it solo, because it's a personal physical challenge, part of the preparing yourself mentally and physically. But also, I reached out to a guy called Tom McLean, who was the first guy to row the North Atlantic solo in 1969. You know, I was 3 years old then, you know, to kind of put it in perspective.
And he did a slightly different route, didn't he?
Yeah, so he went for St. John's in Canada. We actually bumped into Ireland. He literally, you got to kind of cast your mind back to what the kind of what was about in sort of technology terms back then. And I went and saw him in September last year. I was on a cycling holiday in Scotland with some friends and sat down in his kitchen, and he got the original chart out. And I said to things, I said, what did you do for water? You know, because modern boat, you can get a water maker now that turns seawater into drinking water, and it saves weight and all that type of thing. He said, oh, I took 100 gallons of water and thought, hopefully I'd got enough. So that's weight on a boat, isn't it? You know, it's quite a lot of weight you've got, especially when you're doing it solo. And then I said to him, you know, what did you do for a radio for safety? And he said, I didn't have one, because there wasn't any of the satellite technology that we have today. He had a VHF radio that's got a range of about 14 miles at best. And he said, so as soon as he was 14 miles offshore, that was pretty much him. So he didn't speak to anyone until he got to Ireland. And then I was, so what did you do for safety? And the first time he did it, he didn't have any money to buy a life raft. So he didn't even have a life raft the first time around. It was just him and his boat. But when I speak to him about the navigational side of it, which obviously there was no satellite navigation then, he says, oh, yeah, he got his chart out. We pored over his chart. All his fixes were on his chart. And it kind of like fused me from sort of like the days when I learned navigation at school. You know, the teachers would get their Ordnance Survey map out and we'd work out what symbols were, what contours were. It was the same kind of feeling. It was kind of invigorating. So I thought, if someone's going to do the New York to the Isle of Scillies solo for the first time unsupported, it kind of deserves, rather than just thrashing yourself across there as fast as you can with modern technology helping you out in the lightest, fastest boat possible, it kind of like deserves the challenge. You know, it needs to be an adventure. So when you get to the other side, you can talk about the adventure rather than just the time you did it, you know, because you won't remember the adventure because you've been too exhausted. So I've turned it really into a more of an adventure. Obviously, I want to get across as quickly as I can using all the elements in my favor, but I'm going to experience it. You know, I'm going to experience what Tom did and all the famous explorers went around the world using their sextants to find out where they were on their charts. And it's then just starts more of an adventure, you know, so you work out where you are, which direction you're going, and it's up to you then. You're not using technology to help you in that sense.
So what are you not bringing with you that a normal Atlantic rower, if there's such a thing, would have on board?
So all the safety equipment's going to be on the boat, because obviously everyone's got family back in the UK, you know, and no one wants to sort of like take the safety element out of it. So I'll have all the safety beacons that you require. There's a thing called an automatic identification system, which ships use to say where they are and who they are. It's a bit of a requirement on the US side as well. So the US Coast Guard knows what boat is, who it is. And that works on a VHF radio, and it kind of like pings up via a GPS, and it tells you who you are, where you are and where you're going. And I won't have access to the GPS or any of that because, you know, I'm just using the sextant. But what it does, it tells me that there's a ship about to run me over in the night.
That's good to know.
Yeah, so that's the safety element, really. There'll be a life raft, but all the navigation is going to be done the pure side of it, really. When I spoke to Tom McLean, he said the first 14 days when he left Canada, he didn't get a sight. So all he did was head east. So he looked at his compass and just headed east. And on the 14th day, he got a look at the sun around about midday, took a sight and realized he was about 150 nautical miles south of where he really wanted to be. And he said he just sort of like added a bit of north to his heading, really, and over 1,000 miles, he got a little bit further north of the 150 nautical miles. And it goes back to what I call big hand sailing. You don't really mind if you're 50 or 60 miles out or 100 miles out. it doesn't really matter. But it does matter when you're approaching land, you want to sort of like hone it in a little bit more accurate.
Is there a little romantic streak in you there that likes this idea of just you and the instruments and the waves and the sky?
There probably is. I think probably you get to a certain age, I suppose, and you kind of reminisce in the past. You read so much about the original explorers, how they went around the world and how they navigated. It kind of inspires you of what they put themselves through. Whereas today, we could make it very, very simple because of technology. But I just feel the route requires a bit of adventure, something different. So when you get to the other side, you can talk about, you know, I broke the world record and, you know, I did it in, but what was the road like? Oh, I don't know, because I was so tired, I can't remember anything. How did you navigate? Oh, this screen told me where I was at all the time, so I never had to worry about it. So this is taking all that away and a bit more experience of the routes, using nature to navigate with the currents, the temperature of the sea, the clouds, working out meteorology of sort of biometric pressures falling, so looking at the clouds to see if the weather front's coming in, all those things kind of fall upon myself to work out, which is great because I like that. You know, that's what adds to the adventure. And if I'm honest, if I knew what the weather was coming, it wouldn't matter anyway because I couldn't get out of the way of it, you know, because the boats don't go that fast.
What do you think the very specific challenges of doing it your way are going to be? Is it going to be colder because it's further north? I know you're hoping to go in May, but will you have to deal with very cold temperatures?
Yeah, I think to start with, so the big difference is the sea temperature. So what we spoke about, La Gomera, to start with, the sea temperature is like 20 degrees plus. When I leave New York, it's going to be about 8 or 9 degrees. So it's going to be quite cold and it probably won't warm up. By the time I get to the Isle of Scillies, I can imagine it's about 13 degrees at best. So that's going to be cold. The weather systems that come over you tend to be a lot colder. So the clothing that I'll be wearing will be completely different to the guys that do the southern route. The people that do the southern route tend to wear swimming costumes, very, very light clothing, whereas I'll be probably wearing full clothing the most of the time and then quite a lot of the time wearing foul weather gear because of the storms that are coming through. And it will be a lot colder up there for sure.
And are there any other particular challenges? Obviously, there's the navigation issue, but I have no doubt that you will be able to handle that with no difficulty whatsoever. Are there any other things that you're making more difficult for yourself than perhaps the typical Atlantic rower?
I suppose you're making it slightly difficult by doing it on your own, you know, but that's part of the challenge in that sort of sense.
Do you enjoy your own company?
Strangely, no. You know, I prefer to be in other people's company. And that's probably where this another challenge lies on this. When I stop rowing, the boat stops going forwards, you know, and there's a chance it could go backwards because obviously I need to sleep at some point and make foods and drinks and do maintenance on the boat. So that's a challenge. But I'm quite looking forward to that challenge because it's about setting the boat up when you're not rowing, just looking at the weather conditions, looking at the wave patterns, lining the boat up so the waves push it in the right direction, the winds are positive on the boat whilst you're sleeping. So you're always making some sort of like gains towards the Isle of Scillies rather than going backwards.
And what sort of training are you doing for this at the moment?
So for me, physical training, I'm trying to put about a stone on 5 kilos in weight in sort of like muscle mass, really, just to get the upper body, the core, in a strong position so it can take the daily bashes of rowing. Currently, probably doing about an hour's strength conditioning a day and 2 hours of aerobic, which usually is either on an ergo Concept 2 rowing machine or on a turbo trainer or a cycle. So probably about 3 hours at the moment training a day, just kind of building resilience into the body. And as we get closer, that volume of training will go up. Try not to get myself injured as I go towards that.
Yeah. Well, I came across some video footage of you on the erg, and I was pretty impressed by your technique, I have to say. Have you been shown how to use it by by rowers. You look like you have.
No, so when I first came to Hereford, we used to go rowing at Hereford Rowing Club.
And okay.
So I can only describe four lumps of meat would turn up, not very coordinated, and someone would put us in a boat and we'd try not to capsize ourselves, and we kind of learnt to row then.
So you've put in the hours. How much do you think you can prepare for it? Because obviously a lot of the challenges that will come up will be unknown and unpredictable.
I think it goes back to making your own luck. So if you can prepare as best as you possibly can, the boat's in its best preparation possible, you've got the right food on board, and that means you're comfortable in your mindset that you're happy to go. You're comfortable in that sense. But in physical conditioning terms, you're going to have to get row fit as you go along, because you can't replicate that on land. You know, you just can't. That day in, day out, bashing your body's going to get. There'll be days where you can rest in a storm, but then your body might be resting, but you're probably wide awake because, you know, you're probably quite scared in these big storms. But you.
Well, I don't imagine you'd want to do that level of sort of physical endurance training anyway to get row fit, because you wouldn't, you know, you'd be too tired to do the actual row if you did that level of training in advance.
Yeah, so I've worked with Leeds Beckett's sports science department, and it's really having a level of fitness that gives you resilience to then row for periods of time. So I won't be row fit when I start, for sure, absolutely no chance, but I will be fit, you know, and I'll have a certain conditioning with built-in resilience, i.e. strength conditioning, lots of specific movements for rowing in strength type terms, and the cardiovascular is built into the ergo as well as other stuff. You need to keep it a bit fresh. You can't sit on an ergo all the time, because they are a bit of a Marmite thing. You know, sometimes you love them and just get into the routine, and other times you just can't wait to get off it. But yeah, it's getting to a level of fitness that you're happy with, that gives you your best opportunity to get ocean rowing fit without injuring yourself.
It was interesting when I was talking to Elaine Theaker, who was my second guest. She had done the Atlantic, the Talisker Whiskey Challenge. And she said that really the most useful training she did was the strength training. Yeah. Because there are times when, you know, if you're in rough waters, you just need that sheer muscle. And it's not about fitness, it's about strength.
Yeah.
What she also said, and you'll have heard this a million times from every ocean rower, is that it's as much, if not more, a mental challenge than a physical challenge. Do you feel that you have that sort of mental strength from your career?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's like creating a routine that you can sustain. So if you can imagine, you get up in the morning, row for an hour, have some breakfast, row for a couple of hours, have lunch, row for a couple of hours, have dinner, row for a couple of hours, go back to bed, and then do that the next day. But I call it mindfulness, being able to declutter all the stuff that's in your mind and actually get into the moment of what you're actually doing and enjoying it. And I found doing long distance swimming, you know, where you swim for long periods of time, and I'm talking 5, 6, 7, 8 hour, 10 hour swims. Well, when you start, there's lots of things going on in your mind, and then all of a sudden, you just declutter your mind and just get in the moment and enjoy it. And I kind of see, and I'm kind of hoping really, because I've not done an ocean crossing in a rowboat, that's the kind of mindset that hopefully I'll get into. And it becomes part of the adventure then, because you absorb what's going in front of you. You know, there's no one else there to tell me I've got to get up in the morning. There's no one else there to tell me I've got to row. You know, it's down to you, and you've got to create a certain amount of enjoyment of it.
What are you most looking forward to?
As I look at it now, I've broken it down. Someone once said to me, you know, these big challenges is like eating an elephant. You know, you can't eat an elephant all in one go, so you've got to bite little chunks off it. So for me, is I'm really looking forward to getting to New York. Because once I'm in New York and I'm physically there with my boat and I'm in Liberty Landings Marina, just tweaking the boat, I know it's about to happen. Whereas when we're sat here now, there's still that doubt. But the big thing I'm really looking forward to at the moment is actually getting to New York, and probably just behind that is actually setting off. That little nervousness that you have of, my word, this could take me 3 months.
How long do you think it will take you? Do you have a sort of number of days or weeks in mind?
Yes, I've looked at it a lot, and I've spoken to a number of ocean rowers that have done solo crossings in various different oceans. They kind of said, look at what people have taken before in that sort of water and that type of boat. So I've kind of set myself a task of rowing between 30 and 40 nautical miles a day. Some days it'll be more, some days it'll be less, but hopefully it'll average out around there. And if it averages out around there, it'll take 3 months. You've got a thing called a routing chart of the 3 months I've looked at, June, July, and August. And it gives you the averages of the wind directions and the speeds of the winds and the currents in those times. Just getting a big old paper chart and looking at it. And it gives you an idea of which directions the winds are going to come from. And they're quite variable, so they're not always going to be pushing you in the direction you want them to go. Whereas if you looked at the La Gomera route charts, all the arrows on the circles in the months that they do that row are behind them, i.e. they're pushing them in the direction. There's very, very few, in fact, there's zero arrows in the wrong direction. So looking at those, generally it's pushing me where I want to go, but not always the exact direction I want to go. And the thing with wind, when it's strong, it creates waves. And if the wind direction changes after being in one direction for quite a long time, it creates cross seas, which are not particularly good for rowing boats. But that'll all be part of the fun. But in timelines, I'm taking 90 days food.
Oh, you are? That was going to be my next question, actually, how many days food you were bringing.
Yeah, so I've got 90 days food. I'm preparing it now, sort of like menus that I'm going to take. And I'm going to take 10 days spare, you know, which is like emergency rations and such, which will be in a grab bag that if I end up in a life raft or something, that will go in the life raft with me. But is the spare, really, you know, is the reserve. But 90 days, if I needed to, could quite easily stretch out to 120 days. You know, you just kind of like go half rations, as they say.
And will you bring any treats with you?
I probably will do. I haven't really thought about it in any detail yet.
I think this is an important element. You need to turn your mind to treats, because everything I hear from people who've done it is that it can make all the difference. You know, if you've got, you know, obviously the Talisker people row over Christmas, so they have like a little Christmas pudding and some, you know, some fizz or something for that day.
I'm probably going to sort of like pass that on to everyone else to do that. Maybe work out two treats that I can have. And maybe on a Saturday night or something like that, it'll be treat night and, you know, I can pull it out and then it'll be more fun. I can open a little package and it will come from my son or something like that, and it will be a little treat. Each week I could have a different version of that.
That's a really nice idea. So tell me a little bit about the charities that you are raising money for.
The first charity is St. Michael's Hospice. There's lots of charities out there, but I always like the ones that are closest to home because you can actually see the people benefiting from them. I don't think anyone that I live with or around this area hasn't benefited from that charity. And we've raised lots of money for that before. So it was a no-brainer on that. And the other one is the Special Air Service Association that looks after the old people like me, really. You know, when I get old, they'll probably look after me. Yeah, they do lots of good work looking after veterans, their mental health, you know, people that need things like wheelchairs or they've fallen on hard times. It just felt like an opportunity to put some effort back into that, really. And so those are the two charities that that will be benefiting when people donate.
I think it's something that people don't really necessarily think very much about. But I used to do a lot of work for the Poppy Factory, which works with ex-military people who, for the most part, they are struggling in some way with the transition to civilian life. And I interviewed a lot of people who'd benefited from the charity. And I was really struck by how challenging it can be for people to go from such a structured environment to normal life. I know there's some preparation for them, but I know a lot of people can find it really very challenging.
Yeah, I think that's true, depending how long you spend in the military. And I think it's like, even if you spend a lot of time in a corporation for long, long periods of time, you do get slightly institutionalized. You know, you get into sort of like set ways and, you know, you talk to people in certain ways. And when you go into civilian life and into different companies, you know, there is a transition of actually learning the culture you probably can't talk to people the same way you used to talk to people in the military or certain corporations. Something that you might flippantly say, what's quite funny to some person, is actually quite offensive to another person. And a lot of people miss the camaraderie that comes with military service. But, you know, everyone does get to the end of their military service, and you know, there is lots of success stories. But helping out on that little transition period and just keeping that message going that these are the areas that you need to work in really do help people go forwards.
Are there particular challenges, do you think, that people have coming out of the SAS that might not apply to the rest of the armed forces?
To be honest, I think it's the same challenges. I mean, I don't think there's anything special about the guys coming or the girls coming out of the special forces. If anything, I think they're better prepared because their experience may be a little bit wider than the wider army as such.
So going back to the row, are you documenting it in any way as you go along?
Yeah, so I've been doing little videos and little blogs to start with, just little capturing the moments really as it's been progressing. But I intend to hopefully turn it into a little mini documentary as well and get footage along the way, the build up, the packing of the boats, the arrival in New York, the setting off. And for me, it's the bit between New York and the Isle of Scillies, which will be special, and trying to capture as much of that as possible so, you know, I can share it with people when I come back.
And what can listeners do if they would like to support you in some way? What are you after?
There's two sides of it, really. There's what I call partner sponsors that want to be part of the boat, the project, you know, want to champion the project themselves, put their logo on the boat, you know, use it on social media. So if there's any companies or persons that want to become a partner sponsor, they would donate to the project, and any surplus money just goes into the charities. There's no sort of like profit in this in any shape or form. I'm not being paid, you know, I'm just a volunteer of the project that's actually doing the rowing. So there's no cost. And then there's the charity side. So if anyone just wants to donate to the charities that's also supporting the project, it's as little as money as you actually want to do. And, you know, you can feel so good about yourself, and you can track us across the North Atlantic.
So that will be via your website, will it be, rowsentinel.com?
Yeah, so rowsentinel.com is the website. And a little bit nearer to time, the tracking portal will be on. And the fun part of it is there's a tracker on the boat, which you will be able to see back here. So you'll know where I am. But there will also be where I think I am on there. So I will take my site and that will go back. And the web guy will put it on the tracker. So you'll know exactly where I am and you'll see where I think I am.
Oh, amazing.
The fun part of being, you know, sort of like tracking us across.
Oh, that's brilliant. And you're on social media as well, are you?
Yeah, that's right. On the website, at the bottom of the website, rowsentinel.com, there's a Twitter feed, an Instagram and a Facebook feed.
Well, I will link to your website in the show notes, and so people can then track through and find you on social media. And I shall follow you with interest and tweet anything that I can as I hear about it. So thank you so much for coming on. It's been fascinating and incredibly inspiring. I wish you fair winds and all the very best for your row.
Thanks very much.
I don't know about you, but I'm really looking forward to tracking Ian on his row and seeing how accurate his own estimation of his position is, though I'm willing to bet he'll be spot on all the way. I've put details of his website in the show notes where you can see a really lovely video about the row, and I'm also including details of the charities that Ian is supporting. Next week, I have a boat race special featuring the umpires for this year's men's and women's races, Sarah Winkless and Judith Packer. As many of you will know, this year's boat races are going to be held in Ely on the Great Ouse for the first time since 1944. And the race is historic in another sense, in that for the first time it has women umpiring both the men's and the women's races. So we had loads to talk about, and I know you're going to love it. This week, I'm going to be taking part in Race the Thames. And each day, my crew and I are not just rowing an average of over 6K on the erg each. We're also dressing up in a different costume every single day. So please do follow me on social media. And it would be amazing if you could donate as well. I'll put all the details in the show notes. So until next week, I hope you have a great week. And until then, next stroke, easy oar.